Arthrex has been helping surgeons treat their patients better for more than 40 years. Differentiate your practice by offering the Nano Experience, which combines patient comfort with leading-edge, extremely minimal invasive technology. Arthrex Nano Arthroscopy scopes and instrumentation are ideal for small joint access and visualization across the body. Deeply committed to surgeon support and patient education, Arthrex has also introduced the nanoexperience.com, patient resource illustrating the scientific benefits of nanoarthroscopy, detailing a wide variety of applications, and directing patients to surgeons in their area. Visit nano.arthrex.com to learn more about enhancing your practice and providing optimal patient outcome with this game-changing technology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another episode of the Nailed It Ortho Podcast. My name is Dr. Cole, and you are tuned into our Citations Classics, and more specifically, you're tuned into our Trauma Citations Classics, and they have another great episode in store for you all today. They're going to talk a little bit about intertrochanteric femur fractures, a high-yield topic, really, for all orthopedic surgeons or residents, you know, fellows, med students, whoever's listening to this, and they go over some of the, you know, kind of highest-cited articles in this area. Really great episode. I even, again, learned a lot, actually, by listening to their episode. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get into today's episode.
You are now listening to Nailed It, the Orthopedic Surgery Podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to another Nailed It Trauma Citations Classics. It's been a bit. We're excited to be back. We're here talking about the lower extremity, and specifically going to start talking about intertrochanteric fractures. We're breaking this one up into two different groups. We're going to start talking about a little bit about unstable versus stable and kind of that discussion between a sliding hip screw and a more advanced, or I should say a different treatment style, like a submedullary nail or various options along that. And then next time we're going to be talking about a little bit kind of some of the implant specifics and tips for success and how to really maximize your outcomes when talking about intertrochanteric fractures. But we're kind of get starting with some of the background today, and we'll get forward on next week. So buckle up, two parts, get excited. Just for everyone's awareness, on if you're looking at the slides, we have a slide of the OTA/AO fracture classification. On the left, we have the JOT 2018 updated classification that was published. And on the right, we have the more common one that you see online, and the one that you'll see if you search. The older one focuses really where the change really is in the A2 classification. A2 classification originally was really focusing on posterior medial comminution, the amount of involvement of the lesser trochanter, if the lesser trochanter is pulled off, if there's associated comminution with that, and then if there's extension below the level of the lesser. Whereas in the updated classification, they don't focus as much on that and start talking about if the lateral wall is intact greater than 20.5 millimeters. And so that's a little bit of what we're going to be talking about today. Why is that important, and how did that number get chosen? So to briefly talk about sliding hip screws versus submedullary nail, there's a good number of studies showing limited difference in outcome between the two options. However, there's some factors that make a plate more likely to fail. I recommend, if you get a chance, to review the AAOS clinical practice guidelines as well as the OTA EBM page. Both of these have some good data that talks about when and why to choose between the two, and it's good to dive in and just to be aware that these things exist, to be able to review them and let them influence your practice and your studying. The clinical practice guidelines are very, very helpful. The OTA EBM in particular highlights studies that show the sliding hip screw is still a successful treatment, with some even showing less complications than nails. But it's important to figure out when the utility or when treating a fracture with a sliding hip screw may be more likely to fail. And that's really where this classification change came from. Also, where we are still searching to really find the exact place where one finishes. And I don't know that we're ever going to find it, but all of the researchers in the field that are working hard on this are trying to get us closer to that. So when do we not want to use it? That's the real big question. Classically, there's four things we talk about where we want to not use a sliding hip screw. Initially, in 1949, Evans first discussed unstable versus stable intertrochanteric fracture patterns. He discussed posterior medial comminution, which is a loss of that calcar buttress. Can't rely on the bone to help support itself, so you need to add a little bit of something extra, as well as substroke extension. of note, it's important to talk about, we weren't using intramedullary nailing at that time. And so it was just kind of discussion of beware of these secondary secondary failures in these fractures. Those two things have been added to over time. We talked about reverse obliquity, Hidukowicz and JBJS 2001, mentioning that. And then now talking about a fractured lateral wall, as in a reverse obliquity that has a fractured lateral wall. We know that's likely to fail. And then we'll talk about, well, if the lateral wall is not fractured at time of surgery, what makes it more likely to fracture postoperatively, which then causes increased medialization of the shaft, which causes poorer outcomes, which we'll also talk about. And so more likely to fail. So the four things being postmedial comminution, subchoke extension, reverse obliquity, in part because of the fractured lateral wall, and then a thin lateral wall at risk of fracture. Well, here's that fracture classification again for those of you at home looking at your screens. So let's talk about lateral femoral wall thickness. And so this is a paper done in 2013 at a JBJS. This is before that change in classification. In fact, this is the paper that really kind of influenced that change in classification. This is talking about lateral femoral wall thickness, a reliable predictor of postoperative lateral wall fracture and intertrochanteric fractures. And it was done in the Bone and Joint Journal. So the question being, the study design, and the question, what predisposes a fracture to a post-op lateral wall fracture? They're looking at AO and OTA 31-A1s and 31-A2s. Remember, and this is in the original classification, this is talking about a fracture involving the lesser with a simple fracture line, as well as fractures involving the lesser with some more comminution or an intermediate piece. So we're talking about some more increasing posterior medial comminution as at this time. So they used exclusion criteria of non-traumatic fractures were excluded, previous fracture through the areas of exclusion, a tips to ATEX distance greater than 25 millimeters. That's going to be a later show. We'll talk about that, as well as follow-up less than 6 months. They had 208 patients, average age of 78 with a kind of broad spread. And they defined failure as screw penetration into the joints or cut in, breakage of the implant, or a second operation due to implant failure. And they looked at different factors that might influence the failure, including age, gender, laterality, lateral wall thickness, tip to ATEX distance, which once again was excluded at greater than 25, but they also looked at it if it was less than that, as well as gender and fracture classification. So I put the results up here on the slide, but the summary of it is that 31 A2s were more likely to fail, and mean lateral wall thickness was significantly associated with failure. And then to further evaluate that, they found that lateral wall fracture with an average of 18.4 millimeters measured at the lateral wall, as compared to those that did not fracture had an average of 27 millimeters. So they concluded, or what they did is they did a receiver operating characteristics curve, which showed that the optimal cutoff was at 20.5 millimeters in order to have an area under the curve of 0.82. And so that's what's led to this 20.5 millimeter cutoff. And so this is based on a study that they did. They had, once again, they had 208 patients, which included 39 fractures in the 31A2, or failed 39 failed fractures in the 31A2 group, and 3 fractures in the 31A1 group. So 42 fractures, failed fractures overall, which then was able to influence the receiver operating characteristic curve, which spit out 20.5. And an important note here at the end, how they measured it is they went to the vastus tubercle, they went 3 millimeters distal to it, and then they measured at a 135 degree angle, or the angle of your implant up to the fracture. And if that was, and what they determined, if that's greater than 20.5, less risk of fracture postoperatively. If it's less than 20.5, increased risk. And so that's a reason to avoid a sliding hip screw as we interpret this results. And so basically we know thin wall increases the lateral fracture rate. We were able to use some numbers and spit us up a nice cutoff at 20.5. And it's something that we've used to really influence our fixation strategy and treatment of these fractures. But it's really important to kind of understand where this came from and the strength of this study and kind of how to interpret it and when to interpret it. All right. So that is where that change came from. Let's talk about medialization and collapse. And is that a bad thing?
All right. So I'm going to be talking about the next paper, which is femoral neck shortening after hip fracture fixation is associated with inferior hip function. And this is an analysis that was done from the FAITH trial. So as background.
You were talking to me a little bit beforehand about this paper, and you're saying, hey, you know, we're talking about intertrochs, and this one's talking about femoral necks. So I just wanted to jump in and say, you know, we're taking a look at shortening, and shortening is a problem with both of these fracture patterns. And with you smartly pointing that out, we included a couple papers at the end to kind of point out there's some analogies between this. So this is a pretty good higher powered study that we wanted to kind of talk about. And it's important to talk about in relation to our previous femoral neck fracture point too. But it's just a really important thing that Olu brought up beforehand. I wanted to make sure I was also giving him some kudos for noticing that, talking about it, and then also mention it for all you guys.
Right. So like he said, this is femoral neck fractures. We're going to be dealing with the undisplaced fractures. So Garden 1 and Garden 2 classification that were fixed with either a sliding hip screw or cannulated screws. And just the nature of these fixation methods, they allow for compression across the fracture site. And once the patient starts to weight bear, there is some axial loading that occurs. And so a combination of those two, compression across the fracture site, as well as axial loading, can cause some shortening of the femoral neck. So now this study is basically a secondary analysis of the FAITH trial looking at a femoral neck shortening and if that matters at all. If you're not familiar with FAITH trial, it was a multi-center RCT, which was organized by McMaster University here in Canada, comparing a sliding hip screw versus cannulated cancellous screws for fixation of simple femoral neck fractures. And inclusion criteria, men or women 50 or older, who had an isolated femoral neck fracture that was fixed within 72 hours. And looking at femoral neck shortening, they broke it down into different categorical variables. So no shortening, mild shortening, which was defined as less than 5 millimeters, moderate 6 to 10 millimeters, and severe greater than 10 millimeters. And how they measured the shortening is quite interesting, actually. So if you don't mind going back to the first slide, where we have the infographic of the two different fixation methods. So on the right side, you have the sliding hip screw. And so the way they measured the shortening was looking at the AP radiograph and looking at the length of the barrel that's exposed. And if you can imagine, if there is some compression, the length of that barrel will be shortened. And so they measured the difference in the length of the barrel immediately post-op and when they were doing their follow-up. And that was going to give them the shortening value. Similarly, on the left, where we have the cannulated screws, they just measured if there is shortening, you would realize probably that the end of the screw is going to be sticking out a little more. And so they just measured that amount of quote unquote sticking out. That's how they got the values for the shortening in fractures that are fixed with cannulated screws. So now going back to the results, the main outcome was hip function, which they measured using the WOMAC questionnaire. They found that two-thirds of those fractures fixed had mild shortening, and one-third had either moderate or severe shortening. The major conclusion after they adjusted for the surgical treatment was that a greater amount of shortening is also associated with poorer or inferior hip function. And so, quick study, but that shows us that yes, internal fixation would help with union of the fracture, but if the fracture heals in a shortened position, it results in poor outcomes. And this was also reflected in the studies done on intertrochanteric fractures, not just the femoral neck fracture. So in the intertroch world as well, shortening also results in decreased function.
Awesome. Yeah, exactly right. So this kind of it makes sense, you know, if the fracture is shortening or there's collapse afterwards, we'd imagine it would impact their outcomes. And in fact, this femoral neck data shows, and then as we said, those two other a little bit smaller studies also show that there is impact on our patients when they're shortening and intertrochanteric fractures as well. So that's why it's important. That's why we want to prevent this beyond the cut-in and issues from that, from intertrochanteric fractures, but shortening alone can cause some worsening. So that's where we get to, okay, what fractures are more likely to displace or shorten postoperatively? Those are the unstable ones, and that's how we kind of get into this whole conversation and discussion. All right, let's go ahead and take a look now a little bit more at the sliding hip screw versus some newer technology, the cephalomedullary nail.
So in this paper, we're going to be looking at the debate over dynamic hip screw versus short cephalomedullary nail to really determine which type of fixation is better for unstable intertrochanteric fractures. This paper was published in 2015 in the European Journal of Trauma and Emergency Surgery. So let's dive into it. So just a little bit of a background. Really, the main difference between these two types of fixation is that dynamic hip screw, also known as a sliding hip screw, is a type of extramedullary device with a transverse screw to fixate the construct. And that was really the first of its kind. And then you had the development of a cephalomedullary nail, which in this paper, they're really referring to as a proximal femoral nail anti-rotation device, which is an intramedullary fixation that really allows for a more centralized weight-bearing axis. And just if you're following along with the slides on the right side, from Ortho Bullets, we have the AO and OTA classification as well as the Evans classification. In this paper, they were specifically looking at our 31A2s for our AO-OTA classification, but Evans is another classification that other papers will talk about. So just diving into the population. They conducted a randomized trial of cephalomedullary nail, the short type versus DHS at a tertiary university with community ambulators 65 years of age or older who had a 31A2 type intertrochanteric fracture. And they excluded any patients if they were polytrauma fractures, intracapsular fractures, stable patterns. If they had a history of a previous hip surgery and patients who are unable to ambulate. So they were able to randomly allocate 96 patients to the short cephalomedullary nail and 102 to DHS. And thankfully, both groups had similar baseline characteristics, and there were really no differences in regards to the type of anesthesia they received. In terms of the outcomes that they looked at, their primary outcomes were at time of surgery. They looked at operative time, fluoroscopic time, and the amount of blood loss. But some of their secondary outcomes were tip to apex distance that they measured at postoperative day 1 and 6 months postoperative. And then they also looked at ambulation status, survival, and femoral neck shortening at 6 months follow-up. So what they found was that there was significant differences in favor of short cephalomedullary nail in terms of shorter operative and fluoroscopic times, shorter length of stay, less blood loss, and a greater return to unrestricted or independent ambulation after surgery. They also had found that short cephalomedullary nail patients had less femoral neck shortening in compared to previous studies that had shown that higher femoral neck shortening was associated with an increased risk of implant removal and a use of assistive devices for mobilization. And then overall, in terms of complications, tip to apex distance and survival, there were really no differences. And this graph on the right is a Kaplan-Meier survival estimate that's really just demonstrating that there is no significant difference in terms of survival between the two groups over a 3-year period. So overall, the main takeaways from this study are that short cephalomedullary nails are better for treating unstable trochanteric fractures in comparison to DHS. And as we saw from the results, that's due to shorter operative and fluoroscopic time, shorter length of stay, less blood loss, and less femoral shortening. Thus leading to faster recovery and mobilization. But this is in contrast to a longer cephalomedullary nail that may have different results due to increased operative exposure.
Nice. Yeah. Good catch, right? So this is taking a look at a short cephalomedullary nail design as compared to a long cephalomedullary nail design. And that's one of the challenges of the endotrochanteric literature is a lot of times we're looking at one thing versus the other or one group versus the other. And there's also been changes in treatment. And there's also been different generations of nails that have come out. And so it can be difficult to really figure out the exact right thing, or maybe it just tells us there's maybe a couple right things that can be done for each patient. And if we don't have one thing that's overwhelmingly better than the rest of the options, then that tells us there's probably a couple different options and maybe some more work left to be done. But yeah, here it says comparable clinical outcomes, right? So both did pretty darn well, but the shorty nail had some shorter OR time, shorter fluoroscopy time. Both of those things might be a little bit closer to even if we're doing a long nail, a shorter length of stay, that might be playing a role as well. And so the one big thing being the less femoral shortening, right? And so we just talked about femoral neck shortening on the last paper being an important thing for moving forward. And so maybe that is a little bit more important and something that should be prioritized. And so that kind of leads us towards the unstable fractures should be treated or maybe better treated with a nail than a DHS. But we'll kind of dive a little bit further into that conversation, defining unstable fractures is an important part. We kind of did at the beginning. And then for those unstable fractures, does it make a difference between a nail and a DHS?
All right, hey everybody, it's Nick. I'm going to be talking about, is the best plate a nail? A review of 30-30 unstable intertrochanteric fractures of the proximal femur. This was by Tucker et al., published in JOT in 2018. So the implants that we're concerned about in this study, and like we've been talking about, are sliding hip screw, plus or minus a trochanteric stabilization plate, and then our tried and true cephalomedullary nail. So the troch stabilization plate was introduced in the 90s as an addition to the sliding hip screw. Its purpose was meant to act as a buttress against the lateral wall, preventing medialization of the fracture. The sliding hip screw and troch stabilization plate was and still is widely used in some countries for intertroch fractures very routinely. So the purpose of this study was really to look at the functional outcomes of unstable intertroch fractures that were treated with sliding hip screw with or without trochanteric stabilization plate versus a cephalomedullary nail. And the purpose of this, in terms of timing wise, in the 90s, Madsen et al. Published a paper that said, there may be improved functional outcomes with the sliding hip screw relative to the cephalomedullary nail. And there was a string of papers that kind of followed that looked into the functional outcomes and rates of mortality, comparing these two or these types of implants that we can use for intertrochic fractures. And this paper is one of those papers that sort of follows. So the design of this study, it's a multi-center prospective cohort study with 12-month follow-up minimum. The implant of choice was the surgeon preference, so it wasn't dictated by anyone or part of the study. The surgeon solely picked who got what implant. And our outcomes, so we're looking at mostly two things, primarily looking at 12-month mortality rate and secondarily functional status and revision rates for any reason. So we look at the results of this paper, there really wasn't a significant difference in functional outcomes among any of the groups. Of note, men had a higher rate of mortality at 12 months, and those treated with the cephalomedullary nail had significantly lower mortality rate. The highest revision rates of 4.4% were seen with a sliding hip screw. So for those following along with the slides, we've got